Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm your host, Travis, and today we're going to talk about married filing separate traps to avoid. I don't know about you, I'm watching the NFL playoffs. I am a football fan, but also a Swiftie, so it's just the intersection of a lot of fun things. And I'm seeing lots of tax ads on TV talking about, you know, fill your taxes out this way, get help with our online portal, get your biggest refund, yada, yada, yada. So helpful, but does not help with people that have student loans, because the married filing separate stuff can be very complicated. You do not want to put yourself in a situation where you are paying more money in taxes than you're saving in student loan IDR payments. It's a real common mistake, and it's also a big mistake to not file taxes separately if you should. We have a lot of tax people and CPAs that send us stuff all the time that want to make waves and There's a lot of wonderful tax professionals that simply have basic questions and are just, we respond to them in professional courtesy. And then there's the bless their heart 60-year-old CPA that is still angry that QuickBooks desktop downloadable version's not a thing anymore and refuses to move to the cloud and doesn't really want to learn more at the stage of their career they're at, that just doesn't want to do married filing separate or does not want to do community property returns the way that it's specified in the IRS. Maybe that's pompous of me to say that, but it's just kind of true. We have a lot of CPAs that are wonderful to work with, and they're wonderful people that our clients use, and other folks that are really not helpful. And that's one of the reasons why we started a tax team, was just the big gap in the student loan expertise in terms of how you do your taxes. So hopefully some of these tips will save you some money, I think. Title this pod was Married Filing Separate Traps to Avoid. I'm going to explain a couple of the really big ones that we see that could cost you thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars if you do it wrong and you don't need to. The first strategy is, or trap I should say, is, are there big AGI differences in your family's household income? One of the ways that people get really obliterated with big taxes that they're having to pay by doing married filing separately is if one spouse is, you know, a surgeon making $600,000 a year and the other spouse is a teacher making $50,000. Well, if you file taxes separately, what that does is it takes the higher earning person and it puts them in a much higher tax bracket. So you might be immediately completely in the 37% tax bracket, where maybe if you file a joint, maybe you would have been in a lower tax bracket. The best way I can describe this is when you file separately, just pretend that each person would be put into a tax bracket that's like twice their income. And if you're each making $100,000 a year each, then your tax bracket as an individual is the same thing as a married couple making $200,000 a year. It's a little difficult to explain, but basically the gist of it is, the bigger the difference in your taxable incomes, the bigger the hit you're going to pay in taxes for a married filing separately. Usually this can be mitigated if the person that's the lower income earner makes some solid level of professional income. So that might be five figures, high five figures, low six figures. A lot of times those hits that you take on taxes can be mitigated if the incomes are at all similar. And if they're not, sometimes you should not file separately for taxes. So for example, if you're in a common law state, which is a state like New York, in contrast to a community property state, like a state like California, people in New York need to be aware that if you file separately, it's just going to be your income and their income. And what is the tax rate that you're going to fall into? A surgeon with $600,000 of income and a spouse with $50,000 of income in New York, that couple probably is going to be filing jointly unless there's some special circumstances. We'll talk about those at the end of today's show, about what might be an okay thing to do for married filing separately in that situation. But in general, you want to be careful if you have huge income differences. Another big married filing separate trap is if you would lose access to ACA plan subsidies. It's a big deal. More people than ever before have signed up for the ACA. There's really, really generous subsidies for a lot of different people in a lot of different family situations. You can have up to a 400% of the poverty line income and still get some big subsidies. A lot of people don't know this. This is one of the value adds sometimes we throw in on consults. You can even get deductible assistance and copay assistance if your AGI is kind of around like 100 to 200% of the poverty line. I think you can get something called cost-sharing assistance on silver plans. I did this. This is why I know about this. Back in the day when I had a much lower income and I was starting Student Loan Planner for the first time, I realized, oh, wow, you know, if I can get my taxable income in a certain range of the poverty line, then in addition to having subsidies on the premiums, you also get subsidies in the deductibles and the copays and all that stuff in the max out of pocket. So for example, if you have like family size of four and you're 150% of the poverty line income wise, you know, and you're on a silver plan, you legit might have like a $500 deductible with $5 copays with a max out of pocket that might be $1,000 and, you know, almost completely subsidized premiums. So you lose all of that if you file taxes separately, or at least on the premium subsidies you do. So, you know, you could really potentially lose, you know, $1,000 or $1,500 a month of subsidies on health insurance if you file taxes separately and you're on the ACA plan getting subsidies. So, you know, what you don't know can hurt you in this situation. You just have to know about it. There's some other things. Let's relax a little bit and talk about things that cost you money, but maybe they're low four-figure costs instead of five-figure costs. If you have kids under 13, when you file separate, you lose the higher amount for the dependent care FSA contribution. So if you have kids in daycare, instead of doing $5,000 for that, you can only do $2,500. If you have kids in some sort of daycare situation, you also can't take the dependent care credit. You know, usually you're probably claiming either or on those. I mean, that hits usually about $1,000. It's not terrible. It's not great, but like it's definitely, usually you get way more benefit on the student loan side than those loss of those credits. Now there's some other credits as well that you lose. A lot of these are special situations. So some other special situations would be if you have kids that are older and they're in college and you're taking like the, you know, higher ed tax credits, like the, there's a bunch of different names for it, but they're usually like a decent sized tax credit that you get if you have a kid in college. I believe you lose those if you file separate. Another really big one is adoption. Kind of interestingly, you get a very large or can get a very large credit towards adoption expenses if you adopt a child, but you lose that at fairly low income levels if you file separate. Another one that's maybe a little more common is if you do file separately, you pretty well can't even do a Roth directly. A Roth IRA, it's probably the most common complaint we get for people about married filing separately, just because they wish that they could do a direct Roth IRA contribution. They're a little frustrated. Hey, why can't I just put the money in the Roth IRA, dadgummit? And what you have to do is do a backdoor Roth. So you can still do a Roth, but if you married filing separately, then you've got to essentially put money in the after-tax traditional first, immediately convert it, and then it's just a little bit of a pain in the butt. And then you're also subject to the pro rata rule, which means if you have any pre-tax assets outside of retirement plans at work, so in other words, if you have a traditional IRA or SEP IRA or simple IRA sitting somewhere, then you have to pay pro rata taxes on the conversion. And it's just a little annoying, a little bit complicated. So one of the things that we like to do with our SLP Wealth RAA is sometimes move people's assets out of their IRAs into their employer plans, because that removes the problems with the pro rata rule. So somebody doesn't have to pay extra taxes when they do a backdoor Roth conversion, because all those monies were removed from the pre-tax IRAs and put into a pre-tax like 401k or 403b. Means lower fees for us, ha ha, but you know, I don't like money anyway, lols. But basically, a couple other things. So community property states, this is where I said my offensive joke about CPAs living in Texas over 60 years old with two names as their first names that love QuickBooks desktop download version instead of online. That's kind of awkwardly specific, but I feel like that's the central casting of people that reach out angry at us for telling a client to do a community property return. You can Google it, right? Like you can literally Google like community property, married filing separate, Form 8958, you know, splitting income evenly. You'll find multiple different blog posts, ones from like TurboTax and other places, specifically stating this is how you have to do a federal return if you file separate in one of those nine states. It's not an option. You have to do it. So if you live in a community property state and you file separately, you're supposed to file Form 8958. What that form does is it splits the income 50-50 between you and your spouse, and then it reconciles what was reported from your employer to the IRS with the W-2s that you got. So that's what that form does, is it's sort of telling the IRS, hey, by the way, I live in a community property state. Just so you know, this is our actual income, even though our incomes in our W-2 are a little bit weird. And for people that don't know, the eastern part of the United States was settled English colonies, right? Original 13 colonies. So it's based on English civil law, where women didn't have as many rights. And then if you look at the parts of the country that are community property. For the most part, it's places that used to be a part of Mexico before the Mexican-American War in the 1840s. And those states were run by Spanish civil law, where women had more rights in terms of civil code. They could have property. They could have, you know, more powers in terms of divorce and things like that. And so, you know, these states have slightly different civil codes, more based on Spanish law than, and in some cases, French law, like randomly Louisiana and Wisconsin. And that's just why that's the case. So what are those nine states? It's pretty much draw a line from New Orleans to Los Angeles. All of those states are community property states. And then going up the West Coast, you've got California, of course, and then Washington, with Oregon not being one. And then if you're in some of the smaller states, just Google to know what those nine states are. I guess I'll just read them real quick. Arizona, California, Idaho, Louisiana, New Mexico, Nevada, Texas, Washington State, and Wisconsin. Those are the community property states. And those are big. That's a big deal. The reason I was making my joke about the old CPAs reaching out, telling us that they're uncomfortable filing a return that way, it's just because tax software doesn't do it very well. It's a pain in the butt. You have to do some little bit of manual stuff. And also filing separately usually, not always, but usually never saves you money from a tax perspective. So at best, you might be essentially doing a wash on your taxes by doing community property. And the good news is usually people that live in community property states that fill out that form 8958 the right way, split the income 50-50, and actually have a very little, if any, tax burden extra compared to what they would have done joint. But if you tell a CPA that, they're going to say, what? You're asking me to do a lot of extra work. A lot of times CPAs just, they define their scope of services as doing your return, which puts them on the hook for more work if they don't have an hourly fee that they charge you or something, right? And so they've got to do extra work for you for what's the reason again? You want something with your student loans? I'm confused, right? So sometimes we very rarely, like I was joking about, we've got people that reach out that are just like, they can't figure out how to do it in their software and their tax person wants them to do it, or their client wants them to do it because we suggested it to the person being in their interest to do it. And, you know, I think the CPA is probably upset about losing somebody as a client or something as a result of it. You know, it's fine. Like, we want you to either do your taxes on your own because you love it and you can handle it fine, or get help. And whatever your biggest pain point is probably the help that you should seek, right? So a couple other big traps to avoid. Randomly, I didn't know this until recently, but randomly, your Medicare premiums are sky high if you file separately for taxes and your income's over, I think it's about 100-something thousand. Basically, Medicare has like a low middle class rate that people pay, and then there's a not middle class rate that you pay once your income's over, I think it's 400,000. Well, if you file separately for taxes, that rate that really rich people rate for Medicare premiums, that starts at like, I think, about 100,000. So that's more of a deal if you're over 65 on Medicare, by the way. It's not really an issue if you are not in retirement, but we do have increasing numbers of people that are over 65 on Medicare that use our services. So we do have to mention that. And, you know, again, that's not too much of an issue if your income is below 100,000 filing separate. It's just kind of a random thing where if your income was 120 instead of 90, you know, then, you know, you might have a Medicare premium that could be thousands of dollars a year instead of like a thousand or a couple thousand a year. So it's a big difference. A couple other kind of niche cases, if you file separate, small business ownership can be a little tricky. So until 2025, that end of year in 2025, there's the qualified business income deduction from the 2017, commonly referred to as the Trump tax cuts. So that's something that you only get if you're in a particular type of industry, or if you're, I think, joint income is below mid to high 300,000 something. So like if you're a, you know, let's say you're a dentist and you're providing a service, right? Essentially that deduction, that QBI deduction, you can deduct up to 20% of your, I'm oversimplifying, but you can deduct up to 20% of your qualified business income. So it's like writing off 20% of your taxable income, which is pretty nice. But if you can't do that once you're past the phase out limit, which I think is in the 400K range. So once you're above that 400K type income as a joint couple or as a joint individual or joint couple, I should say, that you can't claim it at all because you're in the trades or profession or you're professional, because there's just all these rules when it comes to QBI and things like that. Usually this is, if you have an S corp, if you have an LLC S corp, that you'll know what that is. If you don't worry about it. Where you fall in your taxable income can matter a whole lot. So if you have a business, sometimes you set up like a solo 401k or something strategic to get your income lower from a tax perspective, because suddenly it triggers you being eligible for things like the QBI deduction where you can write off 20% of your income, which is a lot of money sometimes. So that stuff really does impact things. So as a general rule, what I see is, you know, you can file separately and amend your return once it's no longer being used for student loan purposes and get the money back. I'll say that again. If you file separate, let's say you filed separate in 2022 and you didn't need to because they're going off of your return from before COVID, then you filed separately and incurred extra costs on your taxes that you didn't need to. So sometimes this is many thousands of dollars. And you should know that you can amend your return from separate to joint and get all the money back. And it, you know, all you have to do is do that within 3 years. You have a 3-year window after filing your return to do it. And that's a pretty big deal. If you filed separately, you didn't need to, you could get, you know, we've seen people get like 5-figure refunds sometimes from amending their return from separate to joint. So it can be a pretty big deal. And you can file separately and then amend later to get a lower student loan payment along the way too. So who should do that? What we commonly see is if you're going for public service loan forgiveness, probably by the time you're coming to us, maybe you've gotten a few years under your belt, you might only have a few years left to go. Maybe it's 3, 4, 5, 6 years left to go until you get PSLF. Well, in that case, even if you're dealing with some pretty big penalties from a tax perspective, it might make sense to file separately every year and then kind of amend returns in a lump pattern and then wait until you get PSLF for the final 3 returns and then amend them all at once. Is this illegal? No, it's not. There's nothing that prohibits this at all. What we'd like to do is just be cautious about amending the return until it's no longer being used from a tax perspective. And then that's between you and the IRS. You know, you showed your income from a tax perspective, what it was for the entire year to your student loan servicer. And then once it was no longer being used, you filed your 1040X is what it's called. And you just amend the return from separate to joint, you get the money back. So this is a great way to really help yourself quite a bit, especially if you're going for like those shorter forgiveness programs. Now, what we see is the biggest stomach that people have for this is the 10-year forgiveness programs, for the simple reason that if you're going for 20-year or 25-year forgiveness, that's a long time to be amending your returns every single year and working with a tax professional like us, paying extra fees every single year. And it's just a little bit of a pain to do that. Now, you could do it, but generally people don't have the stomach for it, and it probably does raise your audit risk at some level. I don't think it raises it a ton at all. Filing separately and amending your taxes is definitely not on the top most wanted list to the IRS at all. And two, pretty much all the money behind the IRS getting $80 billion or whatever it was of extra funds, that's all going to auditing the wealthy, essentially, people that have very high incomes. Now, if your income's above 400K, then yeah, you know, doing some of these strategies could definitely open you up to a higher risk of audit. That's not necessarily a problem. When you get audited, it's not fun. It makes most people sick to their stomach. But the only time you should be worried about being audited is if you didn't report all of your income. If you reported all of your income, the worst case scenario is you're going to disallow some of your deductions that were too aggressive, perhaps throw on a little bit of penalties and interest on it. And there's things you can do from an abatement perspective or different sort of strategies to try to explain yourself to the IRS to at least reduce or use some of your penalties or get out of some of the penalties. I've made many mistakes with the IRS, both by myself and then when I had different CPAs along the way. And I find that if you, you know, as long as you report all of your income, they're very nice and forgiving. If you don't, so the old joke that I've heard is if you, something like if you overreport your deductions, you might have to pay some penalties and interest, and the IRS will say, hey, you shouldn't have done that. Here's the extra tax you have to pay. But it's kind of like getting a speeding ticket or something like that. You shouldn't do it. Be a good person. Pay your taxes. If you get one, it's not the end of the world. But if you don't report all of your income, that's how you go to jail. So just remember those differences, right? You definitely want to always be truthful on your taxes, but always report all of your income. That's very important, especially with all these new rules. A lot of these like payment apps like Venmo and stuff like that are going to start reporting transactions to the IRS if it's over $600. So you might at some point get some sort of letter in the mail saying, hey, you know, Venmo reported X amount of money to the IRS. Where's our money? You know, and then you might have to say, well, that was being reimbursed for a family vacation, or that was being reimbursed for a trip we took to our bachelor party or something like that. So a lot of weird little things like that. If some of our tax team people were here, they'd want to share some other kind of stories, I'm sure. But I think that Tax season this year is going to be a big deal. I talked today about the married filing separately traps to avoid, but there's a lot of other traps too. One of those traps is, you know, the phrase, the early bird gets the worm. Well, sometimes the early bird gets punched in the face with a higher IDR payment. And what I mean by that is if you have a, you know, an IDR recertification date anytime between like February and October 15th, what might happen is you might just fill out your tax return on time like the hardworking person you are, and then they're going to update your payment with your new income-based repayment. And that could cost you four or five figures in extra costs pretty easily. So an example of this is if you have a July recertification date, you fill out your tax return on time and you turn it in. And let's say you're an attending physician. You went from making $70K a year to $400K a year. Well, they're going to base your new tax return on your $400K a year income, presuming you made, you know, that in the prior tax year, and your payment will be $3,000-something a month. In contrast, if you instead filed your taxes but then filed an extension, then you'd be able to pay on your 2022 taxable income for an entire extra year if you give auto permission to the IRS to share your income. So that can mean payments of like $300 a month. So you could be literally talking about saving like mid 30 grand level savings just from 1 year of delaying your tax filing. That's another reason we started the tax business, is because we realized when they became so focused on trying to automate income information being sent from the IRS to the servicers, you know, depending on how the servicers do this and implement this, they're probably going to want to just use whatever IRS data they have, even if that data is a little bit old. I'm curious to see if servicers start asking more aggressively for more recent income information. I mean, ultimately, we can't guarantee any of these loopholes or strategies will continue to last forever, right? A lot of these things depend on the current environment we're in. And in this particular environment, I think this is a strategy that would be useful. And the other thing is that if the strategy only works for 1 or 2 years, well, you could still get a whole lot of savings out of it. So there's the married filing separate strategy. There's the delaying your, you know, recertification strategy. There's ways, you know, from solo 401k basis or setting up a 401k. A lot of people don't know this, but if you're a business owner, you can get most all of the costs of setting up a 401k paid for in a tax credit. And you can even get, I think it's up to $1,000 of an employer match that you make to employees under a certain income level, also paid for by the government with the Secure Act 2.0. And then you can get a much higher contribution limit for your own retirement and lower your AGI that way. So there's really just all kinds of ways you can save just tons of money. And so taxes is a really big way, you know, to do that. And I would say if your taxes are dirt simple and you have two people with 50K W-2s, absolutely no complications beyond that at all. No kids. You live in a common law state. You know, one of you has student loans, one of you doesn't, you know, sure. Like, just put your info into TurboTax and pay the $100, whatever it is, 50, whatever. I don't even know what it is anymore. But, you know, do that and file your taxes separate and submit, right? But if it's any more complicated than that, like you live in a community property state, you have some side hustle income, you, you know, are kind of a little bit unsure about the filing the extension strategy yourself and being, you know, you do have to pay all the tax due by the April filing deadline, or else there's penalties, even if you do file an extension and submit it in October. You know, if you're concerned about trying to navigate all of the various married filing separate traps to make sure that it's still worth it to file separately. So we talked about things like, you know, losing ACA plan subsidies, Medicare premiums being higher, adoption costs, having kids under 13, losing those credits for daycare, having to recharacterize Roths, pro rata taxation of back to Roths you do incorrectly. So, you know, all these different strategies are really quite powerful. And it's one of those situations where, as of this recording, I'll say the cost of working with the tax team, which is subject to change, and I think I probably have to say some disclosures and stuff, but like the cost of things until I think it's mid-February, there's like a $495 one-time enrollment fee because of how close we are to tax season. And then $99 a month for financial planning, and then $99 a month for the tax service. That's for personal returns. So we bundle it all together where somebody's got to do financial planning and tax with us. The reason we're doing that is because the financial planners and the tax planners are all working together trying to coordinate on the student loan plan and the financial plan and your taxes to make sure it's all like talking to each other. And we just decided that we would rather lose some folks that don't want to pay that fee and don't want to have a full scope of a relationship with us just because we want to make sure the service we deliver is really excellent and the strategies that we're delivering are really excellent. So that's the cost of that. And if you have had a consult before or have not had a consult before on your student loans, that actually doesn't matter because we've got one link that'll take you to the right place. So if you know you want help for tax season, slpwealth.com/tax, what that link's going to do is if you're already an SLP Wealth client, but you're not currently doing tax, you can add tax for that $495 plus $99 a month level. And that link will take you to the right place if you're already an SLP Wealth client. If you're not already an SLP Wealth client, what that's going to do is it's going to ask, you know, essentially, are you a student loan planner client? And if you are a student loan planner client, then you're just going direct to that $495 signup fee plus the $198 for the combined per month, you know, tax and financial planning. And then if you've not done any of that, if you are not a student loan planner client at all or SLP Wealth client, that link will first send you to a discounted student loan consult that we'll do first. And then the other fees apply once you're past that first consult because you've become an official client after that first student loan consult that we do with student loan planner. So if you need help, if you don't need help, great. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast and learned some tips. You know, if you're a professional in the industry, I hope you took my jokes in stride. And we appreciate all the tax and financial planning professionals out there that listen to this podcast and all the folks you send to us for just student loan planning help. We love doing that for folks and hope to continue to do that for a long time. And then for you that are listening that you want somebody to press the easy button for you and just do all this with and for you, and for you to not make this mistake that could cost you mid five figures for a cost that's very, very low compared to the expertise out there, you can go to slpwealth.com/tax. And you can go to that link for, I guess, a couple more weeks before that $495 signup fee jumps up to $995. Essentially, we have oh my gosh, I waited till the very last second fee that starts, I think, in mid-February. So if you want to get help, the cheapest time to do it, if you've kind of put off getting tax help that you know that you probably should have gotten earlier, is to go to that slpwealth.com/tax link. You won't see us in any NFL playoff commercial. Too niche for that, too poor for that. But, you know, slpwealth.com/tax. We'd love to help you if you think you need it. And I'll say a quick disclosure that SLP Wealth is a registered investment advisor with the SEC, with headquarters in Durham, North Carolina. And there's no tax or professional financial advice provided in this episode. It's just for entertainment only, unless you're an SLP Wealth client, in which case you'll be working with your professional advisor. Thank you, everybody. slpwealth.com/tax if you need it. And those are some of the top married filing separate tax traps to avoid as we get really into filing taxes for this very busy tax season that's going to matter a whole lot to student loan borrowers. So slpwealth.com/tax. Thanks, everybody, for listening.